This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, I welcome back Sameer Pandya to discuss his latest novel, Our Beautiful Boys. Vikram Shastri is a good kid. He makes good grades and listens to his parents. They live in a nice neighborhood in Southern California. He plans to go to a good college. He has a chance to join his high school football team. We also learn about his friends, MJ and Diego, and about the boys' parents and their family lives. They are hardworking and well-intentioned. They love their sons. However, they have secrets too. And then things start to change. Vikram, MJ, and Diego attend a party in an abandoned house in the foothills of Southern California. Also in attendance is Stanley, a boy who has always been a school bully. Something happens to Stanley at that party. It's a situation shrouded in secrets and questions. It's a mystery that won't be easily solved, and the very fabric of this tight-knit community is threatened and starts to unravel. How will the boys and their families arrive at the truth and clear their names when there is so much at stake? I spoke to author Sameer Pandya about his latest novel, Our Beautiful Boys. Well, welcome back to Book Public. It's so great to talk to you again. And this time it's about your latest novel, Our Beautiful Boys. I wonder if you can tell our listeners what the book is about.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much for having me. You know, in essence, the book is about four teenage boys who are at a high school party on a Friday night. And nearby there are these old caves. And four of these boys go into the cave. Three of them are friends. One of them is essentially a bully that's been badgering all three of them for years. And about 45 minutes later, one of them comes back down very badly injured. And the novel is, in essence, a thinking through of what happened in that cave, but particularly the ways in which it will shape and reshape the lives of the three families that are at the center of the book.
What was the inspiration for this book? Because you're right, it is about all of these boys and their families and these intersections of some other bigger issues. And I'm wondering, where did this inspiration for this book come from?
Yeah. You know, in some ways, there's a very kind of mundane inspiration, right? Which is during the early years of the pandemic, I spent a lot of time at home in my backyard here. And there are these foothills that kind of are kind of behind us. And I began to notice that kind of in the distance, the foothills there look like what look like caves. And I started thinking about these caves. And A Passage to India, which is the Ian Forster novel, has been always very, very important to me, which, of course, at the center of that novel is this question of what happened in the cave. And so I basically took that question, moved it roughly 100 years forward, moved it from India to California, and I placed these four boys in there, and I went from there, right? And so in that way, that's the original inspiration for it. But there is a secondary inspiration for him, right? Which is, I am in the process of, with my wife, we're raising teenage boys. And so I'm around teenage boys a lot. And I just have been trying to think through kind of the world that they are living in, the world that they're stepping into, how they're managing notions of who has money and who doesn't have money, what masculinity means, what it means to transition from being a boy into particular notions of manhood. So there's a very specific, you know, plot question. And then there's, of course, the other fun thing for me as a writer is to work through these deeper ideas that are working, that kind of won their way through the story itself.
Can you talk a little bit about the boys? They're such an interesting triad. And of course, then there's the bully, but the three boys, Vikram, MJ, and Diego, can you talk about these three? And they're not all sort of the same. You know, they're not all the same. They're very, very different. and they have a lot in common, of course, but they are their own person. I wonder if you can talk about each one just a little bit.
Yeah, so the first one is Vikram Shastri. You know, he is a junior in high school. He is from an Indian American family. His father was born in India. His mother was born in America. His father works in tech. And so they are a kind of fairly well-off upper middle class family. They are also kind of have this notion of kind of Gandhian nonviolence that runs through their family. And a fun thing for me in that context was to think about Vikram playing a sport, football, which is perhaps the most un-Gandhian of sorts, right, in its violence. Number two is a character named Diego Cruz, who is also a junior in high school. He's the running back on the team. His mother, Veronica Cruz, is a historian of Latin American history, and she is kind of raising him by herself. And she is an incredibly successful academic. They live in a very comfortable home. And he loves football perhaps as much as his mother loves him playing football. And the third is a character named MJ Barringer, who is a senior in high school. He is very bright. And all three of these young men are quite bright, quite interested in college. MJ is a senior. He's the quarterback. He is, you know, in essence, from central casting of kind of bright, young, white high school quarterback. He's going through a particular crisis where he's thinking about the wealth his family has. And when this novel opens, he is essentially taken to walking around every day without his shoes on as a kind of protest to the kind of wealth that his family has. I was trying to think through the ways in which these boys live these very distinct cultural lives within their families, right? And the ways in which they are very small, right? That they are, I think, what I was really interested in was their class status, right? Which is that all three of them are fairly well off. I didn't necessarily sit down in writing this book and think, oh, I want kind of three teenagers who are kind of racially distinct. But it works particularly for this book and for this particular story that I was trying to tell, that I have an Indian American, a Latino, and white, three kind of teenage boys, and kind of with very different experiences and then similar experiences at the same time.
There is a line, I think it's the coach, that says something like, you know, this is the most intelligent backfield or something like that. And it goes to this idea that the boys do well in school, but they have the stressors of school. They have the stressors of anticipating applying to colleges and trying to get into college and the pressures of their families. And then also the world of school sports and athletics is also this world all its own of stressors and challenges. The way that that figures into the characterization of these boys is so interesting to me because they have some things in common. They are very distinct also. And then also the ways in which they approach this thing that's sort of unifying them, this team, is also pretty important in the relationship that they have with each other, the way that they are approaching not just the sport or their team, but their own sense of self. And I just found that particular thing so interesting. It was almost like the education part was a little bit of an equalizer. I started to think, was football that too? And it's not necessarily the case because there's this whole other world. There are so many other things pulling at these boys in terms of pressures. And I thought that that is so realistic. I think it's so important to make note of that, how hard it is to be a young person, but also the very particular kinds of things that happen to boys when they're growing up, boys and young men.
Yeah, no, thank you. You know, to your earlier question about, you know, what inspired this book, right? It is that there is something very interesting going on, right? Like, I think in a way, I feel like a week does not pass when I do not see some article about the ways in which in high school and in college, boys are beginning to significantly lag behind their counterparts, right?
Yeah.
And what that means, and these are all anecdotal bits of information, but the ways in which
college admissions, for example, are far more skewed towards young women going off to college and young men deciding that it is not for them. There is this social phenomenon occurring, and yet at the same time, the idea that you are done with high school and you're moving on to college is such a kind of structuring discourse in our lives, right? Especially when you're dealing with upper middle class families, right? It is just a part of what you do. I think that what I was trying to work through in this book is these multiple stressors that these young men are feeling, right? Particularly in relationship to their own bodies, in terms of the violence they feel is inflicted upon them, that they wish to inflict upon others in order to protect themselves. At the same time, there are these three sets of parents in this book, right? And I think early on, Geeta Shastri, who is Vikram's mother, says, you know, where our children go to school is a reflection of the successes we've had as parents. And it's that kind of idea, which is the success of these children become, in some ways, an extension of the kinds of consumption that these parents are engaged in, which is to be able to say, my kid is going off to X college is equivalent in a certain way, and I'm careful in doing this or in making too close of a parallel between the two, that, you know, we went to Italy to summer this past year, right? Or we went somewhere for vacation, we're driving this car. And that is kind of what I was trying to think through is how do the boys internalize this desire their parents have for their success, which in by inference is their own success.
You know, I have a daughter and I have thought of this question, this idea of the idea of success for me is something that I feel guilty about saying this, but that I've imposed upon her, and she is her own person. And that's something with the characters of the parents of these boys in this book. They are such a complicated group of people. They are very loving. They want what's best for their sons, but there is so much else that's simmering underneath the surface that any kind of dramatic situation, and as we know, there's a very dramatic situation that happens, just threatens to upend all of their lives, right? I was thinking about how, and this sounds crazy as I'm saying it, but it's true, how close we all are. We are all sort of this close all the time to having something explosive in our lives just change everything in different ways. But I feel like they have this in common. The boys have this in common. The parents have this in common. And again, they're so different in how they will respond to it. But the complications of the parents, let's say Vikram's parents with their relationship with each other, or the Beringers, their relationship with each other, or even Veronica, Diego's mom, who is, as you said, an extremely successful academic and scholar. She's so into her work and the publisher parish situation, and she's quite competitive too. I think that the complexities that you draw about the parents and these families, we can't say enough about that, because those tentacles really reach out and influence these boys and the ways in which these boys are thinking about their futures, their education, their futures, college, etc., what they can do, the ways that they resist at this age, like MJ not wearing his shoes and so on. But it's just fascinating to me. If it takes a village, I just see the ways in which this is borne out in your novel. It's so fascinating.
You know, it's interesting, that phrase, it takes a village. And it also seems that part of kind of novelistically, what I was trying to think through is how quickly the village might turn on itself. And the idea here that structurally as a novelist, what I was trying to think of is, it's one of the reasons I spend not a huge amount of time, but a chunk of time in the beginning of the novel, having the reader familiarize themselves with the domestic lives of these three families. Right? It's because when things turn upside down, I wanted the reader to feel the stakes of that turning upside down, right? And I think you're absolutely right, which is the house of cards has been so set up that one removal is going to, you know, cause reverberations all throughout this village that you and I are talking about. The second thing that I wanted to think about, and this is the layer that I was trying to work through, which is I am, of course, interested in the ways in which race, but particularly brownness, operate in American life. And in this particular book, what was interesting for me was to set up, in essence, two brown families, right? A Indian American family and a Latino family, whose relationship to brownness is different, the ways in which their brownness is perceived as different. And it is the central node by which Veronica and Geeta are both friendly with one another and are competitive and in great conflict with one another, right? Veronica says, when your son and my son walk into a room, they're going to be perceived very, very different. You said this thing earlier, which really struck with me, which is the guilt you feel in your wanting your daughter to have particular kinds of whatever successes or achievements, or, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what I found I was trying to kind of consider is the ways in which all of these parents feel this, but what happens when notions of possibility are shaped by race, right? So that part of the reason both Geeta and Veronica push their sons as much as they do, because they know in a certain way what the world looks like for boys like them when they become men. It's this thin line, I think, between the guilt of wanting to push your children, but then also a recognition that there are profound complications that await them as they move away from you and down the road, right? And what can you do to set them up for those complications that are coming up? Diego and Veronica have this kind of, you know, she says, look, you're not going to be treated the same way. Diego, who I think, like a lot of these teenagers, is infused in race talk and knows it and is in some ways past it, says, yeah, no, I'm race, I know. Right. And that's, I think, what I was also kind of interested in this parent-child relationship that I was working through.
And there's so many implications there about race and culture. I mean, we talked a little bit about class too, but race, and I would say race is the thing. And I was thinking about how there are these, okay, the pressures that our parents put on us, the pressures at work, the pressures at school, the pressures on the football field. But I think about the existence of something like social media. It's so amped up now, the pressures of sort of fitting into these idealized, you know, TikTok worlds where everybody seems to have it made and there's everything's fun and funny or extremely poignant and moving and beautiful. There's this thing about how our information about the world outside the confines of our insular spaces, our homes, our schools, our communities, it just brings up another level of tension for our young people, this competition about measuring up, as lives on the internet can appear so deceptively perfect. And there are other ills on the internet too, as we know, that influence our young people. Then the idea of bullying is adjacent to that too, or maybe not so adjacent. Maybe it's front and center. It's such a rampant problem on its own. What does your novel say to us about bullying? Especially, I feel like bullying among boys can be something very different, and maybe most especially in the context of high school and boys where race is involved. It's just not an easy thing to understand to begin with, bullying. But then you have this extra layers. So I wonder if you can talk about that.
Yeah. So let me first talk about, I mean, I think they're both related, of course, but let me first talk about social media, which is one of the things I have noticed is I'm walking around or driving around and I see groups of teenagers, right? I'm trying to be careful here, right? Meaning that I am an older person, right? And I think teenagers like nothing less than to be told that they're being sucked into social media, right?
Right.
Just as much as, in fact, they're being sucked into social media, right? But I find this fascinating thing where I see groups of five or six young people and they are all on their phones and they're communicating literally they're showing each other what they're seeing, right? And then they're going back to their phones. And what's so fascinating about that is that they are literally, their personhood, their selfhood is constructed through what they're seeing, right? And I think, so your point about the ways in which it shapes how people perceive themselves, the ways in which they perceive what is the good life, what is the bad life, is all kind of working itself there. The second thing here is, in addition to what they're getting through social media, it also strikes me that there is no part of their lives that is not somehow recorded or pictured, right? Which is this very notion, for example, of like something like Snapchat, right? You are constantly snapping photos of yourself and sending to the people who are in your network, right? And so the very idea that you are a self and the ways in which it is multiplied 10, 20, 100-fold on social media is radically shaping how we understand ourselves, how these kids understand themselves, right? Bullying in this context is in some ways just an old-fashioned thing, right? Meaning that the bullying that occurs in this book is old-fashioned kind of hazing and taunting that Stanley, who is the character who engages in it the most. But what ends up happening is that very idea of bullying gets amplified so much, right? It's because when, you know, Stanley comes down from the caves hurt, and I'm not giving anything away, everyone's phone is out, right? There is no part of this moment, right? So when the principal has to ask the students what happened, all they have to do is just take their phones out, right? And say, look, this is what happened. This is where I was. This is the version of the story that I got, right? And so that is kind of a part of what I was trying to kind of work through in this book with the social media piece. But, you know, your bullying question is, in some ways, it is getting to the crux of what the movement from adolescence to manhood means of these boys, right? And why it is that the movement of it has to come through violence as one possible way of moving through it, right? And of course, the interesting or the ironic thing is that that violence is completely allowed for and celebrated while they have pants on and are playing football, but it's completely kind of denigrated when it occurs once they take their pants off. Right. And I think it's that juxtaposition of the two that I was particularly interested in.
It is so interesting, especially as we see the support from the parents for their sons, and then also the ways that they must contend with the situation with Stanley. There's a doing and an undoing that readers will find, the ways in which all of these families will have to contend with an extremely serious situation. Samir, as the father of sons, what is something hopeful that your novel can also show us regarding the challenges of raising boys today or of being a boy today or a young man today? What do you hope that a novel like this one can show the rest of us about our boys and young men?
Yeah, I mean, I think boys are very noisy. They are contending with a significant amount of noise in their lives, right? And so they are trying to find frequencies through all the noise, and they themselves are kind of engaged in a constant level of talk and chatter. What I am finding, right? So that these are young people who have experienced in a certain way, pandemic, political upheaval, economic upheaval, right? And what I've tried to do in this book, in really trying to get into the emotional lives of these young teenage boys, is that when pushed, when placed in corners, when placed in difficult situations, they are at the same time incredibly adept at kind of recognizing themselves, recognizing what they think is right and what they think is wrong, right? Like, I can't sit here and say every kind of kid has that radar, right? But I think that what I was trying to work through in this book with the three primary boys, but then Stanley as well, is just how much struggle they are going through, right? And so what I am hopeful about is, in fact, how smart these boys are, how resilient these boys are, right? And of course, I'm not talking about my kids. I'd like to think that of my children, but I'm thinking about it much more broadly, right? Which is that they are managing so much. And I think that that is the one thing that I really want to underscore here, is that they have juggled a significant amount, right? And I think they have come through it with a great amount of grace. And it's almost what this novel is trying to do is to, I think, give them the grace that I think they have been trying to create for themselves. And it's hard, right? There's been so much chatter, so much conversation, understandable conversation around kind of where these young men are moving politically, where they're moving culturally and socially, right? And I think one of the things that I've been really hopeful about is they're consuming this information, they're working through it, and they're trying to parse through it as best as they can.
Samir Pandya, thank you so much for talking to me today about Our Beautiful Boys. Thank you so much. So good to talk to you again.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for those wonderful questions and really appreciate the conversation.
Samir Pandya is the author of Our Beautiful Boys. It's published by Ballantine Books. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.